by the Security Council 2 years ago to investigate the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Russia tried unsuccessfully to block a vote on its renewal until after the release of the inspector's latest report, due out on Thursday. The report will look at the chemical attack on Khan Sheikhoun that led to the United States launching a cruise missile strike against the Syrian government's Shayrat Air Base. Syria has denied any use of chemical weapons. The U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley, in a statement, accused Moscow of once again siding with the dictators and terrorists who use these weapons.
The Saudi crown prince has said he's working towards the return of what he calls moderate Islam to the country. Mohammed bin Salman said Saudi Arabia would not spend the next 30 years dealing with destructive ideas. Here's Frank Gardner.
Saudi Arabia's maverick crown prince Mohammed bin Salman is moving faster to reform his country than anyone could have imagined. 4 weeks after it was announced that the ban on women drivers was being lifted, he's pledged to rid the oil-rich kingdom of religious extremism. This won't be easy. Religious clerics have often opposed reforms in the past, and after a previous monarch, King Faisal, overruled their opposition and introduced television and education for women, he was later assassinated.
Kenya's Supreme Court will meet on Wednesday to decide whether the rerun of the presidential election can go ahead. Human rights activists filed a last-minute petition arguing the country was not ready for the poll. The main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, who has pulled out of the election, has urged his supporters to boycott it. The Interior Minister, Fred Matiang'i, told the BBC people could demonstrate peacefully, but rioters carrying stones would be treated as criminals. An astronaut from NASA's Hall of Fame, Paul Weitz, has died of cancer at the age of 85. Paul Weitz commanded the maiden flight to the ill-fated space shuttle Challenger and was a pioneering pilot on Skylab 2, the predecessor of the International Space Station, as Nick Bryant reports.
This was one of the high points of his career. He'd been recruited by NASA in the 1960s and was part of the first manned mission to Skylab, the US orbital space station, in 1973. The mission lasted 28 days, the longest ever manned spaceflight at that time. A decade later, he came out of retirement to join the shuttle program. He was 51. By the time he brought the shuttle into land at Edwards Air Force Base in California 5 days later, he'd logged up 793 hours in space.
World News from the BBC. Iran has sentenced what it called an Israeli spy to death for leaking nuclear secrets, including the addresses of two scientists who were later assassinated. Prosecutors did not give a name, but said he'd sold secrets in return for Swedish residents, leading observers to conclude that it's Ahmad Reza Jalali. Mr. Jalali was arrested in April last year on a visit to Iran. The Russian celebrity Ksenia Sobchak, who's officially announced her bid to run in next year's presidential election, has said she will try to unite those who are disillusioned by the 18-year rule of President Putin. Oleg Bodorov reports.
Ms. Sobchak said there had been no new faces in Russian politics for the past 18 years and that she wanted to give Russian voters the chance to express their frustration. She currently hosts political shows at an independent TV station, but for many Russians she is better known for her role in flashy reality TV shows of a decade ago. It has been alleged that Sobchak's candidacy was devised by President Putin's administration to attract interest to the race. She denied any such agreement and said she would leave the campaign if the authorities allowed the better-known opposition activist Alexei Navalny to run.
Indian police have arrested a loan shark after a labourer burdened with debt set himself and his family alight in the state of Tamil Nadu. The man is in a critical condition. His wife and daughters died. A local official said the labourer had taken out a loan of some $2,000 and had repaid nearly double that amount. The World Health Organization has recommended a new vaccine against typhoid fever. Experts believe the vaccine to be so effective it could help eliminate the disease altogether. Unlike other typhoid vaccines, the new treatment works in children. Typhoid, a highly contagious bacteria spread through contaminated food or water, kills more than 200,000 people around the world every year. BBC News.
Support for this program comes from Women, Food and Agriculture Network, hosting the 20th anniversary of its annual conference, Rooted in History, Growing for the Future, November 2nd through 4th at the Sheraton Madison. The Women, Food and Agriculture Network seeks to engage women in building an ecological and just food and agricultural system through individual and community power. Registration details at WFAN.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places. Truth is
happy noon hour and welcome to the WORT Community Radio Classic Show, a public affair. Where it's a community discussion and we invite you to join us. It's Tuesday and you know what that means. You're expecting Carousel's voice, but she's on assignment today and I am your substitute host, Bert Zipper. And it is my great pleasure and honor to have as my guest, Ricardo Gonzalez. Ricardo, welcome to WORT.
Thanks, Bert. It's a pleasure to be back here.
So, Ricardo, you are an icon, one of those pillars of our community. You're a community leader. You've been in the City of Madison alderperson. You've been the owner of the Center of Madison's Progressive Community, the Cardinal Bar. Your sister city founder with the Cuban sister city, Camagüey. You were a WORT host here for decades on La Junta and so much more. And welcome back to WORT.
Thank you. Thank you, Bert. It's really it's a pleasure to be here and reminisce a little bit as I came into the studio. It's been 5 years now that I stopped doing La Junta. I retired from that. I did it for 37 years.
Oh, man.
I guess I'm a long-term type of person.
You were here the first week WORT was on the air,
weren't
you? That's
right.
Over on Winnebago Street.
That first Sunday, we did the first La Junta on the air.
Man, 1975. And here we are just a few years later, you and me here at the table.
Uh-huh. Here we are.
And we're talking today about sister cities.
Well, sister cities and hopefully a little bit about Cuba and what's going on because there's a lot going on again.
Absolutely.
It never goes away.
You know, it's amazing. I was telling you before we got on the air this idea of sister cities. And we were hoping to have Philip Gurevich on today, and he's written a lot of essays in The New Yorker. And you and I were talking about this before we got on the air. He has this great essay about a speech that Abraham Lincoln made back in the 1830s, where he sort of, the writer, Philip Gurevich, cites this as predicting someone like Trump potentially coming into our nation. Lincoln was talking about a brutal lynching of a young free African-American man in St. Louis named young Mr. McIntosh, and an abolitionist a year or so later, Elijah Lovejoy, killed in Alton, Illinois. And Lincoln was asking in this speech, what was the greatest threat to our republic? And he pointed out that if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of freemen, we must live through all time or die by suicide. He talks about the mobocracy. Lincoln talks about the mobocratic spirit, and that people could go in that direction, where a mob, much like those lynch mobs, had destroyed the democratic spirit. Lincoln goes on to say there's only one solution. It will require the people to be united with each other. And that is what you're doing with sister cities on a municipal level, right? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, really, sister cities, as we know the concept to be now, were founded, really. The whole idea of sister cities was founded by President Eisenhower.
Eisenhower in the
50s. In 1956. And it was a way of lessening the tension that existed at that time between the United States and the Soviet Union and China and that Cold War that was so cold at the time. Mm-hmm. And sister cities was all about municipal diplomacy. People from a city adopting another city as a sister and then going there, sending delegations to visit, establishing trade relations if that was possible, cultural exchanges, academic exchanges. In other words,
all those person-to-person
people
things.
To people, yes, yeah. Person to person, and develop friendship. Above all, friendship and understanding so that not only did you get to know the folks in that foreign city, mm-hmm, as individuals, but you get to know their culture, and they then, in turn, come over to the city in the United States and get to know our culture and how we think and why we think the way we think. What is it in our history that makes us, especially Americans, make us what we are and how we think? So this movement took off, and A city like Madison today enjoys about 11 or 12 sister cities around the world.
Some of those sister cities are like Rafa in Palestine, Freiburg in Germany, Arquetao in El Salvador. Managua, Nicaragua, I think, goes back to the 50s. Your project, Camagüey, in Cuba?
That we put we submitted to the council back in 1994. In 95, it was approved. And, of course, we also have relations with Oslo, Norway. Mm-hmm. We have Vilnius, Lithuania. And there's been a couple of others that have been mentioned. There's a city in Mexico, I believe. I can't remember. It's in Jalisco state. And the Rafa sister city, I don't know if that was finally approved.
I think it's an informal sister
city. It's an informal relationship. So you have all these levels. But the point is that sister city relationships really do bring people together. Because I can tell you from my own experience, since 1995, when we took the first delegation to Camagüey, there's been almost 2,000 people from Wisconsin, because the Madison-Camagüey relationship spawned a relationship between Milwaukee and Nuevitas on the north coast of Camagüey, which was the port city of Camagüey province and the port city of Wisconsin. So between the people who've gone to Cuba from Milwaukee and the people from Madison, we're scratching the figure of 2,000 people from this state
who physically got to Cuba.
Who probably wouldn't have gone had it not been for this particular relationship.
And went there before the Obama normalization.
Oh, back in the day when it was very difficult to travel to Cuba.
Yeah, how did you get there?
Well, we...
you went to Mexico?
Well, let's see. That first time, in those early years, we took trips through Mexico. Mm-hmm. We went through Canada. Sometimes we got a license. Sometimes we didn't. We just dared to go, and we went. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons I left the council in 1995.
It wasn't about me, was it?
No. No.
Maybe a little bit.
let's not go back to that. But one of the reasons really was that I knew in 1995 as... 94, 95, that I knew that sometimes I was going to have to travel to Cuba illegally. Mm-hmm. And I had taken an oath to, you know, uphold the not only the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Wisconsin, but the local ordinances, et cetera, you know. And I was kind of a sticker for that, and I didn't want to be in a position where I was actually breaking the law, even though to me that law was... I always put the embargo on Cuba and the restriction on travel to Cuba on the same level as forcing the black people to sit in the back of the bus. To me, that was it. There was a higher moral issue involved here. And to me, I was correct in every way you want to look at it in violating that particular law.
Now, Ricardo, then, you're born in Cuba, right?
I was born there. So,
and when did you come to Wisconsin?
I came to Wisconsin initially in 1968 as a young college graduate. I had just finished at East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma, and I was hired by the Green Giant Company.
I was going to say, I thought there was...
And Ripon.
I thought you were up in Ripon.
Yes.
I remember that story.
As personnel manager, because Green Giant brought anywhere from, 300 to 500... Tex-Mex workers, people from the Texas-Mexican border.
Farm workers.
Yes, farm workers and factory workers.
And factory workers.
Because Green Giant at that time, I mean...
They had a canning company,
had
right?
a canning company and had a plant. And we had pea pack and corn pack. And the pea pack was usually pretty much staffed by college students and the local kids.
I had friends doing that.
But when corn pack began at the beginning of August, then it went into September. And, of course, the kids, the college kids and the high school kids, all went back to school. Mm-hmm. So the company figured we just have to bring in the... In the old days, they were called braceros.
Yes.
In this case, they were called the migrant workers. And that's how many Mexican families stayed in Wisconsin. They came... on those buses from the border.
We have Green Giant to thank for bringing you to Wisconsin.
I guess.
Wow.
The jolly Green Giant.
Ironies. And the sister city relationship, for listeners, we're talking to Ricardo Gonzalez, the founder of the sister city relationship between Madison, Wisconsin and Camagüey, Cuba. We're going to have a call later on from some other people from other sister city relationships we have in Madison. But right now we're talking about Cuba. So talk about, what does that mean? What does that mean? It's a sister city. So what happens between, what happens in Camagüey, what happens in Madison?
Well, when, let's speak about Madison first. We've had the visit of artists from Camagüey who have been here on more than one occasion. Mm-hmm. We've had the visit of doctors from Camagüey. Every now and then, the university does bring some lecturers who come from Cuba, but they're not necessarily here on account of the sister city relationship. At one time, we had two officials from the city of Camagüey, the secretary of the municipal administration. Council was here with the head of ECAP. ECAP is the Cuban Institute of Friendship with People, and anybody who's traveled to Cuba knows about ECAP. And it's sort of like an NGO, a non-government organization, but it really is part of the Cuban government. So we've had that, but because it has been so difficult for Cubans to travel, and it is so expensive for them to do so, mm-hmm. we have not been able to bring many people over here. It is much easier for us to travel there, even with the difficulties. Because it really wasn't until about 2 or 3 years ago that you could, in fact, it wasn't until about a year and a half ago that you could book a flight on American Airlines to fly to Cuba.
Here in the land of the free.
You had to go through charter operations, and you still can only go there if you have a group mm-hmm. that is organized in some fashion. There's still many restrictions because let's not forget, there is an embargo mm-hmm. on Cuba, and this is a very important thing that folks sometimes forget, is that the embargo is still very much in place. Cuba.
Going on close to 60 years. Wow. Well, and I was telling you before we went on the air, there's such misinformation, fear of Cuba in some sectors. Many years ago, my dad, late in his life, my dad lived in Manitowoc County. He spent his whole life in Manitowoc County. He knew Manitowoc County well. He wasn't really clear on where anything else was. So I brought the globe down. I got in second grade where every country's a different color. Because my wife, Lori, and I were going to Nicaragua, and I was showing him where Nicaragua was in relation to Wisconsin. He goes, oh, well, where's China? Where is this? And at one point he goes, so show me where's Cuba. And I said, look, it's this yellow island right here. On my globe, it's yellow. And he goes, where's the rest of it? I'm like, that's it. That's Cuba. And he was so offended. He was just like, what have they been telling me my whole life? I've been hearing about this great, big, dangerous place, and you're telling me that's it? I'm like, yeah. I was
that,
like,
that little island.
He was so angry and offended that he'd been lied to his whole life, as I think a lot of people are. With sister cities, you get to see the reality, and of course you'd be offended at what you have been told.
Well, I think it was Harry Truman, back in the late 40s, who said, or one of his secretaries, with the Secretary of Defense, or General Marshall, or somebody, who said that the only way to get people, American people, on board of this containment policy mm-hmm. against communism was to scare the living hell out of the American people.
Yeah, of course.
So we had to build
fear is such a powerful...
Exactly. We had to make communism be this monster that was out to destroy us. And there's no doubt. I mean, communism is a very different system. And we can idealize it anyway. Nothing is all evil. Nothing is all good. But communism comes to power where there are injustices. Mm-hmm. If you want to fight communism, then you have to take care of the issues like education and inequalities, mm-hmm. and poverty and ignorance,
all that stuff that we know
we have to deal with. If you don't take care of those issues, especially in a third world, and I'm using
I see the air quotes there.
The air quotes. The third world so countries, cold. You know. If we don't take care of those issues, you will have, there will be ground for communists to develop and to build a movement and to eventually reach power, which they did in several mm-hmm. countries. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that's the end of the world. Because when the communists do take over, yes, changes will occur. Because, and that's what happened in Cuba, huge change. I like to liken it to it's like an omelet. You turn the omelet upside down. And that's what happened in Cuba. Overnight, within a period of about a year, the whole system was changed. And la tortilla se viró. The omelet was turned over, and those who were at the top ended up at the bottom. And those who had been at the bottom were given an opportunity to get to the top.
Exactly.
And that's what happened. And it's been going on down there in Cuba now for 59 years. It's going to be on January the 1st. The Cuban Revolution will celebrate 59 years in power. And we still, the United States, I mean, when I say we, I'm talking about the United States government. Our government has yet to figure out how to deal with this little island.
Right.
That
we figured it out with China. We figured it out with the former Soviet Union. We figured it out with
Vietnam, with whom
exactly.
We fought a war with Vietnam where nearly 60,000 people died. Not 60,000 to mention
U.S.
all
people.
U.S. people, exactly. Not to mention all the millions who died or who were affected one way or another in those countries, in that country. Because, it was Laos and Cambodia also.
Absolutely.
Let's not forget.
Among Americans.
Exactly. But in Vietnam, there was a horrendous war. In fact, Vietnam is a very important point. Now, we need to revisit Vietnam. This program that was on PBS recently, right. on the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. the what's his name? Burns.
Yeah, Ken Burns.
Ken Burns. His program, I think, so timely because we need to understand Vietnam to right. really understand what's happening now.
And oh, yeah.
How Vietnam, when you put Vietnam and Iraq together, just those two, not
right.
No, you don't have to go into any of these other interventions
right.
that we have carried out, all these other interventions and other people's lives and invasions
occupations
and deaths and bombardments and all of it. The list is just unbelievable. But if you just take Vietnam and Iraq, you realize that the United States has been so arrogant.
A very bad neighbor at
best. A real
best.
Bad player.
Yeah.
And that we are going to suffer.
Yeah.
And we deserve every punishment we would get down.
I was just reading, Ricardo, based on that I believe the writer was saying there's only one 5 consecutive year period in the U.S. history when we have not used our military force in other countries. And that was in the 1930s. That there's no other time in our whole history where we've gone 5 years. It's like, oh my gosh, it's that stunning.
Well, and in the 1930s, we were pushing our power in Central America in Puerto Rico.
Oh, we definitely set up a Somoza.
We eliminated many people in Puerto Rico who were independent.
Oh, the independentistas,
yes. Los independentistas, los socialistas, anybody who had those tendencies was eliminated, you know, without any qualms.
So here we are talking about sister cities. Please join us in our conversation here at 608-256-2001. You can also tweet us on Twitter, is my understanding. you can join us on Facebook. We have Shali in there and Tim, our engineer, who can make that happen. But join the conversation. So in the face of all this reality of U.S. Imperialism and military intervention. Here we have citizens in Madison, Wisconsin, and various other cities doing sister to sister relationships.
Oh, it's still going on
to work for peace and justice at the municipal level, at the personal level.
Right. in many countries because the relationship between Madison and El Salvador, for instance, it's very active. It has been for many years.
The Arkatao sister city, right?
We have a sister city in Japan.
That's right.
Obihuro, and that's a very active project. Freiburg in Germany is very active. We like to think that the relationship with Camagüey, in spite of all the restrictions and all the issues about travel to Cuba, we have actually been very successful over the years in continuing to take trips there. Now, what we did in 2003, just a little bit of history here, but because it is important to us here and to the relationship with Camagüey, in 2003, when it looked like the Bush administration was going to really shut down the relationship and prohibit, in fact, which it did, it prohibited the sister city movements from developing and from operating.
The dangerous sister city movements.
Oh, they wouldn't give us licenses or anything like that to travel to Cuba. So what we did is we went around that by organizing a humanitarian project, a medical project, and that gave birth to the Wisconsin Medical Project, which became then our sister organization, our partner organization. And they were able to obtain the commerce license and the travel license. And for the last 14 years, they have sent about 20 containers to Camagüey loaded with medical supplies and equipment. They go there 2-3 times a year to conduct needs assessments. They have an ongoing relationship with the with Camagüey hospitals, with their clinics, with doctors there. And the work that they have done is really very noteworthy, and it's run by some of the most humanitarian people you can imagine.
It's the epitome of think globally, act locally.
Totally.
Now, you've said there's some fundraisers coming up, and how do people get involved or contact?
Well, the situation with Cuba now is it's very complicated because everything was moving along rather nicely toward normalization. Obama, 3 years ago, announced that there had been an accord reached with the Cuban government and that the process of normalization had begun. The world welcomed that news. 70% of the American people supported
it.
Even a majority of the people in Miami, the Cuban-American community in Miami, supported the idea of engagement. Let's put, you know, we can't forget, but let's move on. Let's move forward. So all along, this was moving along, and Democratic candidate Clinton supported that. She would have kept this opening going.
But I think the other guy won.
The other guy won, of course, and he thinks that his victory in Florida was due to the Cuban vote. There's questions about that, but we're not going to argue that now. The point is, he won. He carried Florida, and he is now indebted to the most reactionary, the most anti-Cuba element within that Cuban-American community, which really is an annexationist community. Mm-hmm. They should just stop all this business about Cuba being a country, a nation. No. What they want is Cuba to become a state.
It goes back to the pre-Civil War
era
of trying to have more slave states, the Central American nations, Cuba, the
annexationism,
Caribbean.
That's what's going on here. And then, of course, on the part of the United States, there's always been a policy in place which has been called the fruit policy, the ripe fruit policy. The ripe fruit policy is based loosely on something that John Quincy Adams wrote in 1823 when he was Secretary of State for James Monroe. Adams wrote that Cuba was like an apple, and the apple, by the law of gravity, will fall not too far from its tree. And thus, Cuba, like that law of gravity, when it comes time for it to sever its relationship with Spain, it will naturally fall on the bosom of the United States. So that policy, it's still in effect. The United States still believes that someday, sooner or later, it is going to get Cuba.
The reactionary element. Yeah.
And that we have the right, we have the manifest destiny to have Cuba as ours, and that island, it doesn't matter what the Cubans think. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter that the Cubans want to have a different kind of country. They don't want their country permeated by American culture and all of this stuff. No, it doesn't matter. We want it. It's, you know, Cuba does have about 3,400 kilometers of beachfront property.
Real estate interests are salivating. So you said there's a couple of fundraisers coming up. When are those?
We're going to be having a Latin music fundraiser at the North Street Cabaret. In fact, both of these at the new North Street Cabaret in your neck of the woods.
By Tip Top Tavern, sort of.
Oh,
in that area.
Yes. And that, let me tell you, the North Street Cabaret is a great new room. And it's designed for live music.
So what's the cross
street? It's got a great
there?
Bar. That's North and...
And that other one.
And that other
one. The one that the Tip Top Tavern's
you
on.
You ought to know it.
I know the Tip Top Tavern. I go right by certain other
okay.
landmarks.
Well, the North Street Cabaret is going to host Golpe Tierra and the Acoplados Latin Jazz Group. It's a Latin jazz project that's been going on at Cafe Coda.
And that's at the corner of Commercial and North Street. Tim, our engineer.
Commercial and North Street.
Jumps
there you
in
go.
Here to save me.
Well, Latin jazz and Golpe Tierra, which is Afro-Peruvian music. This is hot dance music. That's coming up this Saturday.
And it's going to be cold this Saturday, so hot dance music would be perfect.
Don't go to that freak thing. Fest, whatever's going on. You know, forget that.
Do a fundraiser for the Camagüey yeah. sister cities.
And we're going to raise money for some donations that we want to take to Cuba. A group of Madisonians are traveling there in November. Talk about continuing that relationship. So,
if people want to get involved in one of these delegations, or is there a website?
Oh yeah, well, not the website is kind of out of commission, but there is an email. It's very simple: madisoncamagüey@gmail.com, and Madison Camagüey. Camagüey is spelled Camagüey
@gmail.com.
So. Back to the because we've been going back and forth here, and we may have confused our listeners. October 28th, 9:00,
this Saturday,
Latin dance at the North Street Cabaret, benefit for Madison Camagüey.
Right.
Then the second benefit, and I'm surprised that Mark Rosenthal is in here, it's the Beat Road Blues. Now, Beat Road Blues, they play as you would imagine, a lot of. Funky blues music, and they're going to do a happy hour
where?
Benefit at the North Street again.
The corner of Commercial and North
and
Street.
And North, yes. 610 North Street. And they're going to do a benefit there on Tuesday, November 7th.
Awesome.
Tuesday, November 7th, happy hour from 6 to 9 with Beat Road Blues. That's going to be fun because awesome. I remember when Beat Road Blues used to do the happy hour at the Cardinal. Back in the day, they always packed the place. And
that is
it was
fabulous.
Fun. Yeah.
Hey, Ricardo, we've got Barb on the line, and I want to invite her into this conversation with us. So, Barb, welcome to A Public Affair.
Hey, Bert. How are you? Hi,
good.
Ricardo.
Hello.
And this is Barbara Olson of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project, right?
Oh, great.
So, Barb,
talk
to us.
We're one of those other very small but very dangerous places.
share your dangerousness with us.
Pardon?
Share your dangerousness with us. What's all going on?
We're not really very dangerous. Well, it's a kind of a long story. Maybe a little background helps explain that. We actually got started way back in 2003 when Jennifer Lowenstein came back from a visit to Palestine, where she had been working with a human rights organization, and she spent time in Rafah, which is the southernmost urban area in Palestine. It's at the very bottom of the Gaza Strip, which is very small in and of itself, on the border with Egypt. And when she came back, she was thinking, why shouldn't we also have solidarity sister cities that were modeled after El Salvador, Nicaragua, maybe Cuba, maybe East Timor, all these kind that Madison have. And so we got started, but we wound up being the only sister city to ever be denied official approval by the city council, and people that were around will remember that was quite a campaign that went on for a year. And so even though we did get a majority vote on the council, we didn't have quite enough votes. And the mayor, Teslevich, at the time, he said he would veto it. And that was primarily due to opposition by people that support the Israel lobby. And so we were charged with being anti-Semitic. We were charged with being supporters of terrorism, et cetera. And we had already said that if we didn't win, which we knew we might not because there actually had never been an official sister city between the U.S. and Palestine at that time due to the same kind of opposition, that we would continue on. And so we did continue on, and we've been going for 15 years. And
So talk about some of the things you've done in 15 years. If you're part of the sister city, what happens?
Well, because we're an unofficial sister city, we don't have access to any of the official kind of exchange type things that people do. We don't have access to any of the Sister Cities International, the kind of resources that they have. So the kind of things that that we have done, I'll start with the delegation idea because that's a very key component, the exchanges of people. So it's actually physically people to people that Ricardo was talking about.
And Ricardo, you've been talking about that, the 2,000 people that have been actually in Cuba based on this.
Right, and so the people from here that have actually been in Rafah in that same 15 years since 2003 is a grand total of 4. And the people that have come here from there is a grand total of 2. And that's because, two main reasons, the U.S. defines a lot of the Palestinian society as official terrorists. And so there are all these kind of laws and stuff that restrict what you can and can't do. But the main reason that we can't sort of get around it, kind of the way Ricardo was talking about, is that Gaza in particular is under a complete blockade and siege, so that it's surrounded on 3 sides by the Israeli military and on the 4th side by the Egyptian military. And so there are only 2 ways to get in, either from the north through Israel or from the south through Egypt. And it's almost impossible nowadays to get in or out of there. Since about 2006, when there was, you know, the fighting between Hamas and the Fatah in Palestine, and Hamas took control of Gaza. So it's become extremely difficult, whereas before it was just a little bit difficult. So people have gotten in to the extent that they have, primarily through the humanitarian projects that we run.
Let's talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, we've done a whole series of those, and I was trying to jot them all down and remember them. But Rafah is a very, very poor place, and it has become almost unlivable as a result of the siege along with the rest of Gaza. So what we have focused on has been fundraising for a whole series of projects, a lot of them aimed at children. So we've put in a playground or two. We've done a water filter campaign where these little filters go into the schools so that they can actually drink, because 90% or more of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. We have helped libraries at kindergartens and a youth center. And then recently, because the electricity crisis has gotten so bad, they have power there like 2 to 4 hours a day, if that. They're production facilities, their plant facilities in Gaza have been out of commission for a number of years as a result of having been bombed several times by Israel. And so they have very little electricity. So we have been sending very modest amounts of what I would call would be rechargeable solar lights and solar systems. We go mainly through bigger organizations that do have permissions to get in, like we've done Playgrounds for Palestine or particularly the Middle East Children's Alliance, that they can get these things in. It's not always easy. There are many stories about, you know, delays and things being rescued from under the bombs and stuff, but basically you can get a certain amount of stuff in there. So that's one of the things that we have been doing. We're running one of those campaigns right now, actually. So
that's great. Sweet
that's really up. Commendable because the bottom line here that you got to, and this is what I hope that you're focused on, is the friendship, the relationship of friendship, the relationship of helping where the help needs to be, the sister city relationship. If you can't have it, then okay, just go around that. And that seems to be what you're doing by focusing on the areas of need. That's what we had to do back in the early 2000s. And then, of course, what we've got to deal with now is that the Cuban government doesn't really put a lot of emphasis on the sister city relationships anymore. And that's coming from there. And to us, it's still viable. Our city of Madison still supports it. But the Cuban government doesn't consider it a priority for them. So we, when we're down there, we're a friendship association.
So that's interesting. So I'm curious with Barb. So what about the government there in Palestine, Hamas or the Palestinian Authority?
This reminds me of something that Mark Rosenthal once told me, who you mentioned, because when we were talking about what kind of model we were going to use, and one of the things that the El Salvador people said was that you have to set up your initial relationship. There's this formal required policy that you go through to be an official sister city. So both governments, whether it's municipal or whatever, they have to sign an agreement and, you know, they agree to do this. They were pretty careful in their case and what they recommended to us, which is don't build, like Ricardo said, build it people to people. Don't build it government to government or people to government, because governments change.
Right.
And so they had that experience in El Salvador, and I think they've had it, you know, like you say, there's been in Cuba and there's many other places. The problem is, so we've tried to do that, to go in that direction, but we're handicapped by, we cannot legally at this point adopt any kind of government-to-government permission because Hamas controls Gaza, and Gaza and Hamas is defined as a terrorist organization. So we would be subject to jail time, fines, all this kind of thing if we tried to do that. You can contrast that with what has happened very encouragingly and very recently, is that there's been two sister cities that finally have been established with cities in Palestine. One is with Nablus, and I think there's another one with Bethlehem, I think it is. I think it's Boulder, Nablus, and there's a town in California that did the other one. But these are cities in the West Bank. And because there's the good Palestinians and the bad Palestinians in the eyes of the U.S. government, and if the good Palestinians are nominally in charge, then you can sort of do this. Even in their case, it took them 3 years in Boulder to overcome the opposition of the pro-Israel people, but it finally did go through. And so when you look at what they do, it is so much more rich and full than what we can do, because they can do these exchanges and they can set up these official policies. I understand what Ricardo was saying about going around some of these restrictions, but these are a little bit different restrictions that you have in terms of dealing with Palestinians. And the other thing that's really different, in Miami, there would have been like a big, reactionary group, like Ricardo mentioned, that certainly would have screamed and yelled and done terrible things if this had been proposed 15 or 20 years ago in Miami. We face that on a national basis because our opposition is nationally organized.
Absolutely.
And that, like I said, this goes all the way back to 1988 when the first one was proposed in Berkeley. And there's been a whole series. The Olympia, Washington had exactly the same experience that we had. There's a number of others that you can look at. That every time this is raised, there's a huge effort to squash it from a very well-organized and very powerful lobby.
I was just thinking, I was remembering back to ARCATAO when it was first set up. I think you raised ARCATAO, and I think that's a great point. Because when ARCATAO was first set up as a sister city, I believe Mary Kay Baum was on the first delegation, and they couldn't make it to El Salvador because it was being bombed by U.S. military.
Right,
support.
And then later on they got in.
Right. It was a war zone.
Yeah.
Well, it's a war zone.
Not to mention that to get to ARCATAO was not easy. You had to, the last leg of the trip was on a donkey or something. I remember hearing stories that were great about the difficulty of getting to the place.
But the importance of what you're doing there, Barb, with that person-to-person stuff, with that highlighting, I just want to commend you. This is important stuff. How would people get in touch with your organization? What's
we are on Facebook. I'm not sure exactly what the call letters of Facebook. But if you go on Facebook, you can like us on Facebook.
Is that Madison Rafa?
Our website, if you just Google Madison Rafa Sister City, it comes up. And our website is Madison Rafa. It's all one word, lowercase Madison, and then Rafa is spelled RAFAH.org. And those are the two places where we are online.
So Madison Rafa, all one word,
RAFAH.org,
or on Facebook.
Yeah, and we're on Facebook. And we have an email and stuff. We don't have an office or a phone or anything like that. We're completely 100% volunteer.
Well, and you're in a lot of places. When I go to a lot of events, the Fair Trade Holiday Festival is coming up in a month or so.
And I was going to mention that. There's two. We've since the very beginning, we have also tried to support people not on a charity basis, but on the basis that we help to market their produce. So we sell olive oil and olive oil soap and a whole bunch of beautiful embroidery.
It really is beautiful.
Different kind of handicrafts. And we source that as much as we can from Rafa, and from Gaza, but it's so difficult. We have supplemented it also with West Bank sources. But the sure. two that are coming up that pretty much all these international groups are at, the big one is the Fair Trade Holiday Festival, which will be at Monona Terrace.
Do you have the date
and
on
that's
that?
That's Saturday, December 2nd. It's always the first Saturday in December. And I think it runs from like 9 to 2 or 3 or something like that at Monona Terrace. If people haven't been there, they should go there and check it out. It's just an unbelievably fabulous place to do your holiday shopping. But there is also a second one that's on the west side every year. And that's at Orchard Ridge United Church of Christ, which is on Gilbert Road, south of the Belt Lane. And that one is always the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And this year, I think that's the 18th of November, and that's usually also, something like 9 to 2 or 3. I believe we have links up at our website somewhere that would give that the actual hours. That one is smaller, but it's also, the same sort of variety of crafts. And they're both fair trade festivals.
So if you're someone listening to us here, please call in at 256-2001 and join the conversation. But you have a lot of social events coming up. You can be dancing at the corner of Commercial and North Street
at the North Street Cabaret.
Yeah, North Street Cabaret to support the Camagüey Sister City. There's a Fair Trade Holiday Fair
coming Saturday.
This Saturday, right.
10/28.
And after you're done with that, in about a month, there's the Orchard Ridge UCC Church, right, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, as well as a Fair Trade Holiday Fair at Monona Terrace on Saturday, December 2nd. And there's also the organizations. You have other events going on. But, Ricardo, you wanted to say something.
Well, I wanted to mention that in between those two, on the 7th of November, Tuesday, happy hour event at the North Street Cabaret with the Beetroot Blues.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I forgot that. I think for people here in Madison and in Wisconsin, these are both two tremendous organizations that really deserve our support and deserve our help. And there's others, the Arkansas Sister City, I've done some stuff with. I've tried to be supportive of all the organizations. What would you recommend for people? What's the key thing? I mean, obviously, if someone has a lot of money, that would probably be really helpful. But what would you recommend for people? What's the best way to be supportive or get involved? Both of you, Barb and Ricardo.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Ricardo, why don't you go first? You can go first.
Well, I was just going to say, right now we have a particular need at this time to raise funds because of the hurricane that affected Cuba.
Talk about the hurricane.
Because we hadn't talked about that. On September 9th, Hurricane Irma, a Category 5 hurricane, made landfall on the north coast of Camagüey province. And it didn't penetrate too deeply into the Cuban mainland, but it went in and then it moved west along the north, the Keys on the north coast of Cuba, causing untold destruction. There are many small towns that disappeared, basically. And it wasn't the total destruction that Hurricane Maria did in Puerto Rico, because Hurricane Maria went in on the southeastern corner of Puerto Rico, covered the whole island, did not leave one inch of that island untouched. In Cuba, the hurricane affected about a good two-thirds of the island, mm-hmm. mostly on the north coast, but it spared the major cities that were to the far east or the far west mm-hmm. in the center, but still caused a lot of destruction, destroying the crops and infrastructure, etc. So we're in need to raise money to be able to deal with this need, and to be able to put together one or two containers of medical supplies and equipment and things that we can take now or that we can ship to them.
Is there a website that people can donate to the medical site specifically?
Here's the thing. The website is not functioning, I'm ashamed to say, but that's the way it is. But they can contact us by email at madisoncamagui@gmail.com. Madison Camagüey, again, CamagüeyGmail.com. Or come to these benefits.
Come to these benefits and get connected.
Exactly. And so that's our main need right now. And it's important. I know there's a lot of disasters everywhere. You know, we had the Texas disaster, the Florida, and then, of course, Puerto Rico, which is so dear to so many of us. And there are events that are going to be raising money for help for Puerto Rico. Exactly. I know there's something tomorrow, Wednesday on the 25th, at the North Street Cabaret. There's something there from 6 to 9 p.m., a happy hour event to raise money for Puerto Rico relief. So
No. Tim, our engineer, just as a sidelight, does point out that back in the past, the North Street Cabaret was a cinder block building, which he had assumed was a CIA covert operations center. However, we do know now that.
You never know.
Well, that's a good point, Barb. That's a really good point. Hey, Barb, the same question to you. What's the best and most important thing that someone who cares, what can they do? How can they best fit in here?
Well, if people who are interested in sending humanitarian aid, there's no shortage of groups and movements to send humanitarian aid to Palestinians because they are living under an occupation. And so if you look at Gaza, for example, it's basically a permanent man-made disaster.
It's
periodically bombarded and then in between starved and bludgeoned.
What would you recommend as the best organizations?
What I recommend to people, as far as an organization, my favorite one would be either the Middle East Children's Alliance, which is MECA, M-E-C-A, and you can find them on the web. They're out of California, and we work a lot with them. And then there's also the Playground for Palestine, which there's a little chapter here, which we work with, and that's a national group. And there's one called the Palestinian Children's Relief Foundation, the PCRF, which focuses on medical. They're just a fabulous thing. But what I really wanted to say is what we need in our case, much more than relief and humanitarian aid, we need a fundamental basic change in U.S. foreign policy in relation to the situation of Palestine, because it is a completely man-made situation that could completely be resolved by ending our support for the Israeli occupation and other policies that Israel promotes and imposes on the Palestinians. And so, for example, there's a bill right now in the Wisconsin State Legislature that just got introduced, which would literally prohibit people from engaging in boycott activities of certain kinds that are aimed at trying to end the Israeli policies.
Boycott and divestment, right.
Right. It's called the BDS movement. And so one might ask, what is the Wisconsin legislature doing? And this is similar to what happened just last week in Texas, where people suddenly were told that they would have to sign forms that said they would not participate in BDS in order to receive hurricane relief.
And again, BDS stands for boycott, divestment?
Divestment and sanctions, only in the case of Israel. It's just applied to Israel. They were not going to be given hurricane relief unless they would sign a piece of paper that said that they did not support that and would not support it, and the reason is that the Texas legislature passed one of these laws. So this is being percolated right now in the Wisconsin state assembly. And if people want more information on that, they should check out our website and our Facebook. We just found out about it, and we're just starting to figure out.
And again, that's MadisonRaffa.org.
MadisonRaffa.org. Or our email, if people want to email, it's Raffa Sister City, all one word. Again, Raffa, R-A-F-A-H, at yahoo.com.
At Yahoo. We've got about a minute and a half left here, and I want to give each of you a chance to sort of give a last word. So, Barb, let's start with you.
Well, that was kind of my last word. Okay. We're in a situation. The whole point of the Solidarity Sister Cities from years ago in Central America, they were part and parcel of the movement to change U.S. foreign policy, because at that time it was a war zone.
Absolutely.
There was the Contras. There was all that stuff. And that's exactly what we are. We are not only involved in the humanitarian and the people-to-people, but because we care strongly about those kinds of issues, there is an important need to focus on what U.S. foreign policy is doing to contribute to this disaster. So I guess that would be my final word.
Barb, thank you. And Ricardo?
Well, you know, Bert, we didn't even talk about this, the so-called sonic attacks that have been in the news lately that have been perpetrated supposedly against U.S. embassy personnel in Havana. And I just got to say one thing about that. And my message is to listeners and to folks who are thinking about going to Cuba, don't believe the hype.
Exactly.
Just go to Cuba. It's perfectly legal to go, and you do need to go with some kind of a program. You need to go under some authorized travel, but it is not that difficult. And the Madison Camagüey Sister City Association and the Wisconsin Medical Project continue to organize travel to Cuba. But you can do it with other organizations nationally. The Wisconsin alumni takes trips to Cuba. It is perfectly legal to travel to Cuba still. So don't, there is a travel warning that was issued by the State Department, but that is all politically motivated.
Absolutely.
As Trump and Marco Rubio especially is now in charge of Cuba policy and running the show, and they want to see how much damage they can do. And of course, number one in their agenda is roll back the Obama legacy.
Everything.
Anything Obama did.
So I want to say thank you, Ricardo Gonzalez, for being here with Madison Camagüey Sister City. Barb Olson, thank you for calling in from Madison Raffa Sister City. Tim, our engineer, has let me know that at the North Street Cabaret on the 25th of October, which is a lot like tomorrow, there's a Puerto Rico relief fundraiser there from 6 to 9. It includes dinner. And Tim, in the engineer's booth, thank you so much. Shali, Molly, everyone else here, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to be your host. Again, I'm Bert Zipper, and we're turning you over to Tim and the 1 o'clock great program here at WORT. Thanks, Ricardo. Thanks, Barb.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're in tune with listener-sponsored community radio WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be Letters in Politics, along with the latest in news from the BBC. Stick around.